Hello, friends. It's the Environment Show, and welcome. The city of Indianapolis struggles with solutions to its solid waste problem, including the highly controversial mass burn method. Also this time, don't dump illegally in New Jersey. It's a crime, with jail time awaiting, a trend developing across the nation. And Dr. Susan Buck, professor of environmental law at the University of North Carolina, Greensboro, says environmental protection means more than just obeying the law.
People need to be doing what they should be doing out of conviction that it's the right thing to do, whether they're going to get rewarded for it or not, or whether they're going to get punished for not doing it or not.
The Environment Show is a national production made possible by Hemmings Motor News, the national Bible of the old car hobby, monthly from Bennington, Vermont, and by the J.M. Kaplan Fund of New York. And this is Bruce Robertson. While environmental regulators say that municipal solid waste incinerators can be operated safely today, not many communities have embraced them as the answer to their solid waste crisis. But there are three incinerators burning municipal trash in Illinois and Indiana. They are in Chicago, East Chicago, and Indianapolis. Bill Rack visited the Indianapolis incinerator and prepared this report.
The first thing that hits you when you walk into the Ogden Martin Systems incinerator warehouse, where trucks are lined up to dump their loads of garbage, is the smell. It's not pleasant. The second thing to receive your attention is the source of the stench, an enormous pile of every kind of trash you could imagine.
What you're looking right now is basically a wall of garbage. It's 50 feet from the concrete pillar to the very back wall. The tipping floor runs 270 feet long, and the storage pit is 42 feet deep. So you can see how much, it gives you an idea how much garbage you have. We go up on
Jim Ball is the facility administration manager at Ogden Martin Systems of Indianapolis. Ogden Projects operates close to a dozen what they call resource recovery facilities around the country. This one went online in December of 1988, and it has a 20-year contract with the city of Indianapolis to burn Marion County garbage. Watching the trash come in for just 1 hour, it's not hard to believe that the facility is essential to meet the city's needs. Ball says that the incinerator has been working at its maximum capacity for the last 2 years.
In fact, last year, well over 30,000 tons was diverted to the local landfill simply because we were at capacity. So we expect to be in that situation for a while, and you know, as recycling picks up, obviously that's going to help, but we think that it will continually be a situation in which the plant will be running fairly close to capacity.
There are actually three incinerators inside the Ogden Martin building. They can burn more than 2,300 tons of garbage each day, and that's every kind of garbage. Food, metal, plastic, glass, yard waste, dirty diapers, everything.
This facility is called a mass burn facility, in which the garbage comes in, whatever comes off the truck is dumped into the storage pit. There's no human handling of the waste by our hands. It's all done mechanically, no prior separation at the plant. That basically in Indianapolis occurs at the home or at the business. The recyclable materials would be pulled out at that point.
Some would argue that having a mass burn incinerator in town would reduce people's incentive to pull recyclables from their trash at home and at the office. But Ogden Martin claims that the amount of aluminum and glass coming into the plant has decreased. And Indianapolis does recycle aluminum, glass, newspaper, and used motor oil. The Ogden Martin incinerator uses the heat that's created in the garbage furnaces to create steam, which it sells to Indianapolis Power and Light Company to heat the downtown business district and Indiana University Purdue University's Indianapolis campus. The steel that remains after incineration is sold to area scrap vendors for recycling. The ash that's left is trucked to a nearby city-owned and operated monofill landfill. It's the incinerator's other byproduct that has it in trouble. Last summer, the city cited Ogden Martin for failing a test on its smokestack. In November, the state and the Hoosier Environmental Council intervened in the action against the incinerator, and new questions were raised about violations of emission limits. Ogden Martin continuously monitors its carbon monoxide and sulfur dioxide emissions, temperature levels, and opacity which is a gauge of particulate matter in the smokestack plume. Jeff Stant of the Hoosier Environmental Council was astounded when he examined the plant's own records.
In the two-year period that we looked at, since they got their operating permit, they violated those four parameters 230 times by their own admission in the monthly reports that they're required to submit to the city. So it's a situation where you had weak limits to begin with, and then Ogden Martin abused those limits, and the city did nothing.
The city says it did nothing because it did not view the periodic instances of noncompliance as a problem. But after the state and the HEC got involved in the case, the scope of the city's enforcement was expanded to include those pollution violations. Specifically, the HEC charges Ogden Martin with allowing carbon monoxide emissions over twice the legal limit for extended periods, and with shutting down its filtering systems, letting toxic metals enter the atmosphere. When Ogden Martin's Jim Ball is asked about air emission problems, he will only say that the facility tries to meet the limits outlined in its two operating permits with the city and the state.
You know, right now there is some discussion among our environmental groups about those permits, and, you know, I guess we're continually looking at ways to improve our system, but, you know, we feel that what we've got here is the best there is in the industry. It's basically state-of-the-art.
No one seems to know if the alleged instances of repeated air pollution violations have been harmful to the people and environment of South Indianapolis, where the incinerator is located. Even the HEC's Jeff Stant can't say for certain what effect the permit exceedances might have had.
But I can tell you this. When they set those permit limits, they set them because an environmental risk assessment said if you set them at this level, it's safe. Now, when the operator repeatedly and excessively violates those levels, then all bets are off on that. And so what we do know is we don't know what the impacts are, but they were potentially serious and adverse.
At least one person isn't worried about the emissions impact, and that's Jim Ball.
I have no problems working here. I feel very safe working here with knowing how we combust the materials and the type of air pollution control equipment that we have. I know I'm safe here.
Negotiations between the city, the state, the Hoosier Environmental Council, and Ogden Martin Systems are continuing in an attempt to reach an out-of-court settlement on the alleged permit violations. A city spokesman says the incinerator operators have remedied many of the emissions problems at the plant, and the frequency of short-term exceedances has dramatically improved. If an agreement on fines and future operational corrections cannot be reached, though, the case will be heard by a Marion County Circuit Court judge. I'm Bill Rapp.
Bill Rack reports from WILL on the campus of the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign. Scofflaws take notice. If you pollute, you pay. And not just a hefty fine. There is jail time waiting. Leading the way is the state of New Jersey, once something of a haven for such scofflaws. Under the supervision of the state's new environmental prosecutor, Stephen J. Madonna, the county prosecutors in New Jersey have served notice.
It represents a new approach in New Jersey, and it is an unprecedented approach anywhere in the world, really. What makes it so unique is the fact that for the first time, one individual has enforcement authority over all the three component areas of environmental enforcement in general. That's criminal enforcement, civil enforcement, and administrative enforcement.
Though New Jersey is leading the nation in forging this new approach to netting and prosecuting environmental criminals, Richard T. Nixon says the movement can be seen all across the nation. Nixon is director of the National Environmental Crimes Prosecution Center in Alexandria, Virginia.
For many years, people around the nation, not just in the prosecution community, but environmental regulators and just the average citizens around the nation, have not necessarily viewed environmental problems as those which would incur possible criminal penalties. Consequently, there have been situations that have gone on time and time again where there's been no appropriate punishment for actions that in effect, have either caused people to become extremely ill or in some cases have caused people to die. Now we're faced with this situation where we have to look and reevaluate, and we're doing that on a constant basis, reevaluate the perspective from which we view these kinds of actions. This, and in particular, I'm talking about typically hazardous waste disposal, sometimes solid waste disposal, transportation, treatment, storage, things like that. But in essence, the regulatory approach to dealing with environmental violations has not worked.
Why is that, though? Why haven't the various statutes on a federal and state level, the laws and regulations, been effective? Endangered Species Act, Clean Water Act, and just many covering solid waste and toxics and so forth. Why haven't these statutes been effective?
Well, in some ways they have been effective. We can't make as too broad a statement here. But given the choice between criminal enforcement and civil enforcement, I think it's important that everybody reassess the situation, take another look, and see what has been effective. Clearly, criminal sanctions are much more effective. All too often, it's been my experience and the experience of other prosecutors around the country that civil regulatory approaches to these types of violations are viewed simply as a cost of doing business. Oftentimes, it's far more convenient for a corporation to violate the law and then pay the fine. Sometimes the fine is even tax deductible.
You don't just accidentally commit a burglary, for example, or unknowingly drive 20 miles over the speed limit, or a drug dealer, for example, is presumably aware of the illegality of the activity. But how are you proposing to define what is criminal and what is, well, more or less, negligent behavior concerning environmental law?
Well, it's a new or should have known standard. And there is a certain amount of discretion granted prosecutors in these instances. And what we need to do as prosecutors in a very responsible way is take a look, an overall look at the alleged crime committed. I'll give you an example of that. I think sometimes it's best to explain these situations by way of example. In the case of someone transporting hazardous waste, if it's being transported illegally, but unbeknownst to the transporter, just loads up a couple of 55-gallon drums on his truck and drives down the freeway, and all of a sudden, whatever might be in these drums, let's say it's an acid, which would be considered hazardous, starts spilling onto the road, and people are injured either by way of, this was an actual case at one time, acid spilling on a freeway where the tires of cars were actually melting, causing some traffic collisions, things like that. That's clearly a case where somebody should have known better, but went ahead in a very negligent fashion, and that's criminal activity.
To be sure, we are talking here especially about the business person engaged in some type of activity, but as the law is designed, says Nixon, it applies to everyone.
As local prosecutors, we tend not to target any one type of individual. But I will tell you that this kind of crime, this kind of activity, cuts across a very broad cross-section of individuals and entities. If everyone were to dispose of waste oil by dumping it into the sewer drains or the storm drains, we would obviously have an environmental nightmare on our hands. Therefore, that is something that local prosecutors do look at.
In the 2 years of operating in New Jersey, Stephen Madonna says he has heard the response from those arrested and charged, "Why are you picking on me? Everybody does it." But Madonna says individual decisions do have an effect.
We tend to think as citizens that we can't, by being one person, do very much. But the reality of it is that when we begin to think alike and each one does its thing, we come to find that cities are scattered with litter and paper because one person does the same thing as one other person does, and it becomes a city of litter, and so the reverse is also true.
Stephen J. Madonna, the new environmental prosecutor for the state of New Jersey. Richard T. Nixon is director of the National Environmental Crimes Prosecution Center in Alexandria, Virginia. It was established in the spring of 1992 with funds provided by the Federal Department of Justice and administered by the National District Attorneys Association. Nixon says a key function of his job at the National Center now is to survey the work of the more than 2,500 district attorney jurisdictions around the country to enhance those procedures that are working and dismantle those that are not. He says his goal is to design a sort of environmental prosecution SWAT team to conduct immediate investigations and begin prosecutions as soon as a potential crime is reported. This is Bruce Robertson. Remember the 1967 motion picture, The Graduate? Wondering about a career, The Graduate was offered only one whispered word of advice: plastics. Plastics was to be the growth industry of the future. 25 years later, with but a little twist, plastics, or how to dispose of them, may still represent the growth industry. Solid waste, or by extension, any of the dozens of environmentally related careers, one of the hottest being environmental law. Teaching political science and environmental law at the University of North Carolina at Greensboro, Dr. Susan Buck says environmental law is a field more and more students are choosing.
Well, I think this is one of the growth industries, and it's almost a limitless opportunity for students. There are jobs available in the public sector at the local level, at the city and county level, at the state level, and also at the federal level. And they range everything from managing parks and recreation facilities to hazardous and toxic waste, monitoring and cleanup. Recycling, of course, is incredibly important. The state that I live in, North Carolina, has passed a law that requires all municipalities to have a 25% reduction in their solid waste flow by 1994, I believe. I'm not sure on the year. Somebody's got to manage that. Someone has to figure out how to do it. And so there are job opportunities there.
Buck says there are also many potential positions within the private sector.
Compliance with federal regulations. You have to understand what the regulations are in order to make sure that your company's in compliance. I had a phone call last week from a man who works for an organization that makes airplane parts, and they have suddenly had to comply with the new clean air regulations in North Carolina, and they're the only company in the state that has these kind of manufacturing processes. So he doesn't have anybody else to talk to about what he needs to do to comply. There's a great opportunity for somebody looking for work. Waste reduction in the private sector, legislative liaisons, people who watch the legislation, who lobby, who translate for the corporation what it is the government's up to. Mitigation. Repairing places, if you're a phosphate miner on the coastal area, you have to go back in and restore those. What counts as restoration? How do you do it? How much is it going to cost? Job opportunities there. And also in the private sector, there's research.
Also increasingly available are positions overseas in regions only recently beginning to tackle environmental problems. Buck cites the former Soviet Union as an example. In part to provide her students with a good reference book and in part to offer citizens and business professionals an overview of environmental law, Buck has recently published a book titled Understanding Environmental Administration and Law. In an early chapter, she traces the building of the environmental movement through the 1960s.
In 1963, the amended Clean Air Act authorized federal hearings on potential air pollution problems. In 1964, the Wilderness Act set aside tracts of land and barred them permanently from development. In 1966, the Endangered Species Preservation Act was passed. In 1968, the spectacular American Apollo spaceflight that circled the globe produced moving photographs of a fragile planet. Early in 1969, a major trigger event shocked the American public into demanding immediate action to protect the environment. On January 28th, Union Oil Company's Platform A began to disgorge oil. Over 11 days, 235,000 gallons of crude oil spread out, ruining 40 miles of Santa Barbara's beautiful Pacific beaches. Thousands of birds and mammals died. One dramatic photograph shows an oil-soaked bird surrounded by debris and gazing in a doomed stupor over the surf. The spill became a national event, searing the public conscience with images of ruined water and pathetic dying animals. 5 months later, the Cuyahoga River in Ohio caught fire. One of President Nixon's aides wrote that the political mood in Washington engendered by the public outcry could only be captured by the word hysteria. On January 1, 1970, President Nixon signed the National Environmental Policy Act, arguably the most important piece of environmental legislation in the century.
Dr. Susan Buck reading from her recent publication, Understanding Environmental Administration and Law. Though the signing of the National Environmental Policy Act may indeed be the keystone act of the century, Buck says the environmental movement has actually been growing since 1890.
That was the year that the U.S. Census formally declared the American frontier closed. There was, at that point, no more land in this country that was not laid claim to by either an individual or by a government. And people like Roderick Nash out in California say that that was a jolt to the American people. They had thought they didn't need to conserve because if you ran out of land where you were, you could always go over the next hill and find some more. And all of a sudden, there wasn't any more land over the next hill. So there was that in the late 1800s that gave people pause about what they were doing. We also saw the eradication of some species. The bison came very close to disappearing. Teddy Roosevelt is actually the last person to have a confirmed sighting of a passenger pigeon in the wild. And the passenger pigeon flocks used to be covering the skies like thunderclouds. You saw no end to the flocks, and then all of a sudden they were gone. So that was a real revelation for a number of people.
Buck says you can actually say some environmental awareness can be traced back through early English common law, where we read of laws regulating what you can and cannot do with your own property, and even further back to Judaic codes.
The origin of the rule for keeping kosher has to do with sort of animal cruelty issues, and there are rules in the Torah that one says, for example, that you shall not muzzle the kine who treads the grain, and that you have to leave certain things out in the fields for the gleaners to come through. So I think that's all part of the ethical and the philosophical foundation of environmental law that we've seen take off in this century.
Buck says her students tend to fall into two categories to explain why they take her course. There are those who feel they need it en route to law school. Then there are those who see it as a corollary to environmental sciences courses. Either way, the students are preparing themselves for some type of professional career that will not only be enhanced by, but actually require, a thorough knowledge of the laws and history of environmental protection. No matter what Congress legislates, what the courts rule, or what the president decides, in the end, Buck says, real change and real protection of our environment must not hinge on the passage of more laws.
One of the limitations of the law is that it is generally reactive. Rarely can politicians take the time to deal with issues that aren't issues yet. So they tend to pass laws to solve problems, not necessarily to avoid them. And that's why I think, you know, law is just one of the things that you get to use, and you have to use it well. But I'm not sure that it's the panacea, it's the answer to everything. I think law is a tool. It's something that we can use to as a weapon to stop people from doing certain kinds of things. But as any kind of coercive measure, it can't be the only thing. People need to be doing what they should be doing out of conviction that it's the right thing to do, whether they're going to get rewarded for it or not, or whether they're going to get punished for not doing it or not.
Dr. Susan Buck, professor of political science and environmental law at the State University of North Carolina at Greensboro. Her book is titled Understanding Environmental Administration and Law, published by Island Press, Covello, California. This is Bruce Robertson. And that's our report on the Environment Show this week. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-767-1929. Ask for the Environment Show, program number 140. That's 1-800-767-1929, the Environment Show, program number 140. The Environment Show is a presentation of National Productions, solely responsible for its content. Dr. Alan Shartok, executive producer. This is Bruce Robertson. The Environment Show is made possible by the J.M. Kaplan Fund of New York and by Hemmings Motor News, the national Bible of the old car hobby, monthly from Bennington, Vermont.